came to live here for about 18 months, 2 years, while it was very bad.
Oh, wonderful.
So I feel that, you know, I've always had that connection. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay.
Right.
Just hang on. I'm going to just start by, I'm going to ask your name and, you know, your date of birth. Mm. And then we're going to start. So I won't interrupt very much. I'll just ask her what was your earliest connection. And if you can remember sort of time. Do you know what I mean? Dates, close as possible, you know. Because when I'm going through it and trying to put them in order with all the other different people, sometimes I'm not sure, when are they referring to someone's listening to? And I don't want to keep stopping. So if you remember that would be great. So today's the 26th of November, 2015. I am with Mrs. Marion Pritchard in the first floor lounge at Sycamore Court, and I'm very honoured and proud to be with one of the, someone who's had a lot of active experience of being in Perry Common. So Marion, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Are you happy for us to go ahead with the oral heritage recording?
I'm quite happy, yes.
Okay, this will be for the archives of Witton Lodge Community Association and the library, and for the community and people who are interested in learning from the experience of Perry Common, the wonderful Perry Common story. Okay, so if you would just like to state your name and your date of birth, please.
My name's Marion Pritchard, and I was born on the 3rd of March, 1936.
Okay, we can start again. Is that okay? Yeah. Your name, please?
Marion Pritchard. And I am. I was born on the 3rd of the 3rd, 1938.
Great. Thank you very much. Marion, what was your earliest sort of memory or your first encounter with the Perry Common area?
I had several aunts and uncles that lived on the estate. They were rehoused in the 1920s, round about 1926. They lived in back-to-back houses in Newtown Row, Aston, and there was a brook that ran through. And this brook was encased into the new sewerage system for the city of Birmingham, which involved all the people in the roads that my relatives lived in, having had their houses from private landlords. A lot of them came here, five aunts and their husbands and children, and three uncles, and they were all scattered all around the estate. But still, that close community tie from being from one big family. And during the war, when the bombing was very severe in Aston, they were trying to get the Saltley Gasworks, which we lived by. I came to live on Perry Common to be out of the way so that I was safe, well, safer. And I stayed here for about 18 months, 2 years. And as the war was slowly won and the bombing stopped, I moved back to live with my mum and dad. But of course, they came up every weekend, and it was I didn't feel threatened in any way because I was with family and I'd got cousins of my own age, and I was quite happy. And I stayed here till it was safe, and then I went back to Aston. And in roughly about 1970s, I moved back onto the estate with my husband and two sons into a boot house. And that's where the story starts.
Right. Can you, just before we move on to that particular beginning, what was it like living here? I mean, do you have any memories of your uncles and aunties talking about the how it was in the boot house and the experience of coming to the new Perry Common estate, the first Perry Common estate?
When my aunt May especially, who was the aunt that I stayed with, for them to be moving into these boot houses, it was like a palace. They moved from a back-to-back house with no bathroom, an outside toilet that was shared by several families, and no water running in the house. You had to get your water from a standpipe in a communal yard. And to come up to a house with running water that could be heated with the back boiler in the lounge. They'd got running hot water, a bathroom and a toilet just that belonged to them. It was like a palace. I mean, it was heaven to them. And they really appreciated, and they appreciated the fact that the whole family was moved en bloc and wide roads, grass verges, trees, plenty of parks round. It was like they'd moved to heaven.
And your experience during the war, what do you remember of that?
I remember the bombings. I remember going down the air raid shelter when the siren went. And even to this day, when a factory siren goes, you hear it in films, it goes, ooh, my stomach clenches tight, even now. And I, you know, I think I was foolish all those years ago that I lived through it. And yet I still get that frisson of fear when I hear a factory siren, because as the bombs came over, all the factories sounded their hooters, and you knew that it was time to go into the air raid shelter.
So that's very interesting. So what you're describing is the Perry Common experience of the war.
No, so that is the Aston experience. That was what I came to Perry Common to get away from.
So when you were here, what, there were air raid shelters here? I've heard of a few.
Yes, yeah, but they were only token air raid shelters. I don't think people ever went in them to that extent. For a start, they were above ground. The air raid shelters in Aston were not underground completely, but a big hole was dug. The shelter was put in, and the dirt from the hole was thrown over the top. On Perry Common, you never felt that fear to do that. They just stood in the garden, and you just walked away from the house and went in. Very infrequently, though.
So, what would have been the war experience like in Perry Common then?
Just an ordinary child's upbringing. I didn't feel threatened in any way. I felt safe. Very little air raids and with my family, and I felt safe. And I think that feeling of safety was why when I went back to Aston, I always wanted to live on Perry Common. And when my house in Aston was demolished and we were asked where we wanted to live, I said Perry Common.
Okay then, before we're moving, just a little, so you were a teenager?
When we moved in here, the first time, I moved here when I was about 7 or 8 during the war. And the second time I moved in to live here, I was in my 30s.
Right, so just a little bit about what it was like, food you ate, going to school in Perry Common in that time. You know, presumably you were in a brick house, or you were with one of your family. You were in a boot house with one of your relatives.
Yes, that was a boot house.
Right, if you could just give us just what it was like then, because obviously you've experienced the wartime, the boot houses in your 30s, mm. and then coming to the demolition. So do you see what I mean? They're mm. distinct. Just to give listeners an idea of just what life was like in a safe, relatively safe.
One thing that was very weird about the boot houses, but nobody then, years later, people complained about it, was that there were five doors in the kitchen. It was a small kitchen and there were five doors. You'd got a door to the back garden. You'd got a door to the bathroom. You'd got a door to the pantry. You'd got a door to the living room. You'd got a door to the coal place. You kept your coal in a bunker in the house with a door on. And a door to the toilet. So you've got five doors from the kitchen. You've got room for a table in the middle and a sink and a stove. But that was about it. But no, everybody thought it was absolutely wonderful. It was only in the 60s when people started complaining about there was nowhere to put a cupboard and nowhere to do this. Because you'd got a larder, you see, and everything went in there. And so the council did a modernisation scheme that turned the bathroom and toilet round and made the kitchen, took the pantry and the coal bunker out and made the kitchen bigger. And that was nice, that was. But, you know, we used to say, you said, oh, are you living in one of the five door houses? Or, oh, no, I've been modernised.
And do you remember shops, food, what the quality of life was, standard of living?
Well, of course, we were on rations and everybody had their share and it was up to the lady of the house to eke it out and that. But I never felt hungry, never went hungry. And we, you know, people grew their own vegetables. The gardens didn't have flowers in. They were all taken over to vegetables and you had fresh vegetables out the garden. And it was a good time to me as a child with none of the worries, you know. And we had a lot of shops on the ring, mainly owned by the co-op. There was a vegetable shop, a grocer's, a butcher's, and then there was a hardware shop with an independent trader and a little place that sold clothes and things, and one side of it was for ladies, one side was for gents. And there was a laundrette in later years and a carpet shop. All the shops are still there now, but of course the usage has changed. But you hadn't got to go anywhere really. You could get everything on the ring. The milk and the bread was delivered by horse and cart. And you had your milk delivered and your bread. And you used to go out and feed the horse with carrots that you'd sneaked out the garden.
When they delivered, was there anything they said? How did the milkman say anything, or was it just plonked?
No, he just plonked the, you heard them coming, like, but he just put the milk, fresh milk on the step and take the glass bottles away. And then the next day he'd come and it was a 7-day-a-week delivery. And the baker came and as well, he would knock the door and hand you the bread, which was a national standard loaf, that everyone had it the same. And by Act of Parliament, they were allowed to put so much sawdust in it. And it was, when I say sawdust, don't think of what you strew on the butcher's floor. It was treble milled wood, and so much was allowed in each loaf. Not a vast lot, but it saved flour. If you put a little bit of this finely milled sawdust in each loaf, you could make 10 extra loaves and do 110 loaves instead of 100. And it was, I've said this to people, and somewhere it must be that it's where in the archives that it was allowed, because every now and then they would set the amount that could be put in. You know how the government have the budgets and things, and it's a, that it, you could put X amount of sawdust in the bread.
That sounds fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Okay. So, did you have Rag and Bone Man?
Yeah.
Did they say anything?
No,
like they were coming down. Rag and Bone Man picked things up.
Yes, they used to shout, "Oldy rags the iron." Oldy rags the iron. The old rags and iron. But of course then, as the war progressed and we were running out of things, all the scrap was collected by the government, and round the ring there was a railing, and I remember going up one day and standing watching these men cutting all the railings down with, it was an oxyacetylene, what is it, oxyacetylene cutter, but I just thought it was magic, you know, and they cut all the railings down and took them away. And they said, "We're going to build Spitfires with them, you know, all right. Later on in the redevelopment, when we wanted to put a railing round the church, the ring, we said, "Oh, no, you can't have planning permission. That's not allowed. You can't put metal railings round a big thing like that." And I said, well, it was there during the war. It was took for scrap. One of the other ladies that was on the committee said, "I've got a photograph of me standing by it." So we brought it in to our architect and our clerk of works, and he took it with him to the planning office, and we got the railings. So now the children can play on the ring, and you haven't got that fear of them running into the road. So we did get the railings back. But I mean, it took, 40 odd years or more. But this is, you're involving a local community. I mean, I remember them coming down. And Rita Sixton, she'd got this photograph of her standing by, swinging on them, photograph taken by a family member. And hooray, another battle won.
Wonderful, okay, great. Yeah. We've got some flavour of what it was like then. That's the most detailed and, you know, coherent description I've had of that period. I don't know, some people, maybe they glide it by or whatever. So now, when you came the second time?
Yeah.
The second coming.
We moved into our house in Hastings Road. It was a wide road with half circles of grass and trees, and we'd all got a nice big garden, and I'd got to the place I'd wanted to be at for some long, long time. We moved in, I'd got one son still at school and the other one at work. And we lived there quite happily a lot of years. And 2 weeks before Christmas in 1989, a letter arrived on the doormat. I couldn't believe what I was reading. It said, "If you've had this letter and it's addressed to you, your house is going to be demolished, and we're going to rehouse you. The government won't let us build any new council houses, so we're not really sure as yet where you're going to be rehoused. It will be dotted round the city where there are houses that fall empty. Come to a big meeting," which wasn't being held till the middle of December. We found out afterwards that that was when the original letter was to be delivered. But the Birmingham Mail had found out about it, and they were going to print an article in the paper that weekend, which meant that the people of Perry Common would have been informed by a newspaper at what was happening to their estate. The estate was in turmoil, people meeting and talking and going in one another's houses and poring over the letter, hoping there was more information there. And slowly the time rolled round, and we went to this meeting. Because there were so many people to go to the meeting, with the fact that it was 1,160 houses, it was decided to hold it at the Comp School, which is just over two nights. It was a nasty meeting. It was a row of people sitting behind a table on the top, all in grey suits and white shirts, and we looked at them and they looked at us, and the chair of the meeting was Stan Austin, that was the housing head of the Birmingham Council. And it really was nasty. Full of shouting and waving arms, and the police were standing around the edge, and some people were really, really nasty. Some were in tears. I went with my husband, and I just sat there bemused at it. And finally, a little bit of order was managed, and he said, if you want to say, this was Councillor Austin, if you want to say in what's happening on your estate, you must band together. You must join together and form a residents' association and fight for what you want. Our hands are tied, yours aren't. So what I would like you to do is set up four residents' associations. There's too many of you for one association. So we had north, east, south and west. Our area was the south. And we were all asked to go to a meeting in our various areas on different nights at the local school. Now, posters were put up around the south area. Leaflets were delivered. Comes the night of the meeting, we go trotting up to the school, go in, big room, lot of council people, thus I was to get to know and work with. And five people turned up. There was myself and my husband, and my next door neighbour Jackie and her husband, and a little old lady in a knitted woolly hat that we used as a benchmark for years to come. And she'd come because they weren't emptying her dustbin. She totally got the wrong idea of what the meeting was. And years to come, we would say, oh, it was a good meeting. Even the lady in the woolly hat came. It was sort of like a ninja. But yes, there were four residents at this meeting. And we looked at the council people, they looked at us, we looked at our MP, and he looked at us. And we all went outside and looked up and down and reread the notice to make sure, A, we'd got the right place, and B, we'd got the right time. But we hadn't. Why there was such apathy, I do not know. Because the other associations form quite easy. So you can't elect nine places on a committee and only four people turn up for the meeting. So it was cancelled, and we set a meeting for a month's time. In that month, we put posters up. everybody you saw in the street in our area to say, oh, look, why don't you come to the meeting? We can have a say in what's happening. Please support us. The next meeting, 60 people turned up, and we got enough to run the meeting and elect a committee. And that was the start of the Southern Area Residents Association.
Excellent. And when you describe the first, that was the first meeting when five people turned up?
Yeah.
The very first one?
The very first meeting to try and form a residents association in the southern area of Perry Common.
And could you then describe sort of how, what strategies were used to get enthusiasm going for 60 people and then onwards, you know, how did things develop onwards?
We twisted arms to get other people to come and made them promise, and I don't know, they just came. I think the only thing I can put it down to is that they were a bit shell-shocked and didn't believe that what they said and what they wanted would have anything, any sway in the problem. It was a complete apathy. It's and even to this day, I seem to think, you know, I think, well, five people, only four really.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much for that. So, so then from there, how did it develop? Because I know that the next part of the story, that it, or there was a period of consultations and so on and so forth.
Any committee, as a residents' association that is set up, is made with people of differing abilities. And everybody has got their own idea of what they want to happen. Some bull in the china shop sort of thing. Other people sit quiet and say nothing. And myself included. My idea of a good meeting was go there, sit there and get out without having to say anything. And I nearly died the first time the chair said to me, what do you think about this, Marion? Where's the door? But we had to start training and the council trained us. And then some of the men had experience of union meetings, and we got a couple of shop stewards there, but the majority of us had never done anything like that. So we were trained in a very nice, pleasant, happy, informal manner. We went and we learned what, how to be, to chair a meeting, how to be the minute secretary, how to be the treasurer, and we were taught in a fun way. We had a week's residential course to start with at the James Gracie Centre, which is a part of Birmingham University. And we learned a lot there, meeting with the council officers and playing silly daft games at first to break the ice. But we slowly learned. And we went to all sorts of things. How to negotiate and compromise was one of the first tutorials that we went to. And we learned on the job. And I mean, for it took a long time to get the actual redevelop. I mean, you've got to clear your ground. You've got to rehouse the people. And I mean, it shows you again this apathy came. Because the brick houses would have been ideal if they could have cleared one area. But they couldn't. They did eventually. But every 6 months, the surveyors came round the boot houses and checked them. sometimes they would say, oh, you're fine, you've got another 6 months. Other times, which they did to us on one occasion, was say, I'm very sorry, your house has deteriorated so badly that you must get out within 2 or 3 weeks if it's possible. You see, the boot houses were made of an experimental system of building, which involved bolting concrete panels together, and then the roof was put on the top. Now, bear in mind, those houses were built in the 1920s, and they originally were only thought 40, 50 years at the most, and they were still standing. But the salts in the soil had crept up the panels and corroded the straps and the bolts that held it together. And the walls were slowly moving out, and they got to such a point, it would, the roof would come down. Now, I've got pictures in here of houses braced up with, like that, and people were living in there for a good week till they could find them somewhere. So if your house was condemned, no matter what phase it was in, 1 to 5, you'd got to get out as a matter of urgency. Some of the houses that had been sold under the right to buy were compulsory purchased back from the people that lived in them. They were paid 95% of the value of a house that was sound. And as most of them had qualified for a good discount because they'd been council tenants for a number of years, there was quite a rush of people to sell them back. And they had the money and went. This left houses around the estate that were in not such bad condition as the other ones. They were given over to a housing association who did them up and let them to anybody that wanted them that lived in a boot house that had been condemned as structurally now unsafe. So you could go in that place and live in this other boot house that was a better one and move into a proper house when they were built. But the problem arose that they could not give you a letter or anything else that said you would definitely get a new house if you decanted. You decant wine from one bottle to the other. That's what they did with people. They put us out of the bad boot house into one that was quite sound and then moved you into a new house, or in my case, bungalow, when it was built. But they could not commit you themselves to giving you that in writing, which I think is why so few people decanted. There was only three families in the southern area that moved into a decant property. I was, myself and my family was in another house, boot house, in Dovedale Road for approximately 10 months because when we had to come out, nothing was ready. But of course, once the buildings were ready, people moved straight into a new property. That is why you've had such a lot of trouble to find people that have decanted, because there were only three families.
Okay, only three families were moved into decant houses? Mm. Okay.
In the whole of the southern area, which I think was about 106 houses, something like that.
Okay. And could you explain a little bit about how then the solicitors, the advice, the architect, what was the engagement? Because obviously some people left, they just they just left. They sold up and they just moved away.
Moved away, yes.
Now, was that to do with the fact that they didn't think anything was going to come? I mean, at what point did these new houses and the association and, you know, what we have now, how did that come into the vision?
It was, Linda would tell you best on this. You see, when we first set up the committees, you didn't have to go to everyone. You didn't have to go to legal and finance. You didn't have to go to community involvement. And then the other one was design and building and design, which is the one that I went on. And my husband was a committee member as well, and he went on the legal and finance. So you weren't expert in every branch of what was going on, and you met at occasional board meetings when the picture was explained more. But you were sort of more expert in your own area, which was fine when we got a big pool of people to draw from. But as they left the estate and were rehoused, you suddenly realised that everybody on the Legal and Finance Committee, there was only two left. So you had to double up, had to get some people from this committee to do too, because the core of people that you were drawing residents from was getting less and less and less.
Because people were leaving or finding other ways.
But yeah.
When you say you had these, how's these different sort of departments almost, that was for what purpose?
That was for setting up the community association and building the houses ourselves. We had a firm of solicitors, firm of architects, worked very closely with the City of Birmingham Building Services and their clerk of works and things like that. And again, learning all the while. And you had to have faith in the people that were leading you, i.e., the solicitors and that, and to make sure that, you know, you were doing what was allowed. And the architects came from Leeds and they designed the... I first realised just what... that I could make a difference when they bought the plans of the first houses that had been designed. And I looked at them and I said, oh, Richard, that was the young, one of the young architects, who was a green architect. I can see you don't clean windows. He says, why? I says, well, the one window pane here. I says, you've got 12 little windows like that. He says, yes, but that's what they were like in the original boot houses, the very original ones. I says, yes, and they was, can you work out? My maths won't do it. How many corners you've got to clean? Oh, he said, when he came to the next meeting, the plans were there and the windows had got one pane. And I thought, I did that. I did that. You know, and it was a realisation that we, even little things, we could alter. But there were things that would impact on people's lives. And all over the estate now, when the ladies clean the windows, they've only got four corners to clean in per window.
Wonderful.
Not 48.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I've heard other little details like that about the letterboxes being in the bedroom and things like that, and the not having sleeping policemen. And but just to go back a little bit, how did it come about? Or you saying Linda would? How did it come about that new houses were going to be built? And do you know what I mean? That period, you know, what changed?
There was a small scheme over the other side of Birmingham that had houses that were defective. They weren't boot houses. There was one or two houses built with this construction, and they were, it was, memory's going. It was a small association and they only had to replace 30. So in actual fact, they were a pilot scheme for Perry Common, because the people in that area started an association with the same architects and solicitors that we used, and we went to visit them, and that we saw their lovely houses and how it was all laid out nice. And we had basically their plan, their their blueprint and their mission statement, and adapted it for Perry Common, because, as I say, it was only 30 houses they had to do. They were about two-thirds of the way through, and they gave us a lot of advice and a lot of help, which we brought back to Perry Common. We didn't follow it completely, but it was a start. It was something to put down and talk about and adapt for our own needs.
What was it called?
I can't think what it is. It's gone. Linda or no?
Okay.
She'll tell you who it is.
So you described the getting the letter, the people being disturbed, organising, but at the point at which it went, we can get hold of the land and build our own houses. Do you remember anything about that?
Yes, it was Birmingham City Council. This is it in its very simplest form. Gave us the land. When the land was cleared, they gave it to the community association that had been set up, was legally correct, everything had been signed, articles of association, everything was above board, legal and correct. And when the area was cleared of houses, it was phases 1 to 5. When phase 1 was cleared, I was in my decant house, and we got this land, and it was divided into 3. 1/3 was sold for private building, 1/3 was sold to the housing association that was nominated as our partner, and the other 1/3 was ours. And the money that we got for the land, for the 2 phrases that were sold, paid for our houses to be built with a small mortgage. But we could never have built them. We could never have built on the whole of it with no money coming from anywhere else other than raising a mortgage. But we had the money, and that's how it worked all the way along. And it worked very well. But towards the end, when the price of land got dearer and dearer and dearer, and the last piece of land that we were able to do it on was worth something like £1.25 million just for the land, the way we were building had to finish. We couldn't build anymore, and the estate wasn't finished. But it was changing times, the fact that the price of land had quadrupled or more in the time that we were doing it. But it was a good system when it first started, and it worked really well. And it's, you know, and we had some luck. One of the council officers was walking through an office in town. This was at the very beginning. And one of the people he worked with said, "Have you got any land cleared at Perry Common?" And the fella said, "Yeah, why?" He says, "You haven't got enough to build 30 bungalows, have you?" He says, "Yes, we've got three or four plots that will take that." He says, "Well, we've got the money for a housing association to build 30 bungalows. The plans are drawn up, the money's there, everything's ready to start, and they've discovered that the ground is contaminated." He says, "And unless it started by March, which was about 5 months, the money will go back to central government." So that's where you get your Phoenix Rise little bungalow estate. And those bungalows that should have been built the other side of the city, and they came over here, and the architect got all the land and that. And we thought that was the best place because it was near the shops and the rings and the buses. And those were the first things that were built on Perry Common. But it was just the fella being in the right place at the wrong time. And this other council officer was running round desperately trying to find some land to build his bungalows on. So first bungalows built. Should have gone the other side of the city.
Very interesting. Thank you so much, Mary.
Can I have a sweet now? I've gone dry.
Yes. Shall I get you? Do you want tea?
No, all right. Okay? No, fine.
We're not gonna do that much.
Not no.
I think it's quite intense. Irene, I'll just ask you one last question, then we can hold it. Because I think a break a couple of weeks later, maybe you know. Maybe in January we'll do another, because it's, and also you remember things in different, like if you just, after this you probably remember something, just jot it down if you think it's important for people. But I just wanted a little bit of, just a few lines on what it was like when the houses were going down. Because that lasted quite a while, and from what I've heard, a lot of people have sort of skipped the details. Like Mary just went, "It was hell." And then she just moved on to something more positive. But I think it's important because, you know, people had to go through that to get to where we are now.
Originally, they were going to demolish all the houses. 252 brick houses that weren't affected. And they were built mainly on the corners of road junctions and practically all the way down Witten Lodge Road. Now those houses were not defective, but to give the architects and the builders and that a clean sweep, they did, the council in its wisdom decided to demolish the lot. At that first meeting there was a lot of people who didn't want their house to come down because there was nothing wrong with it. So they all got together and had their own solicitor and that and fought it. And because there was nothing wrong with the houses, Birmingham City Council couldn't evict them, buy them compulsory. So now you've got all your boot houses to come down and you've got your 552 sound houses remaining. With hindsight, later on, most of them said it was the worst decision they ever made because they had years of demolition round them. Lorries, builders, and I mean, one house on a corner had it all down that side first. That was complete, and then it was done down the other side. And they had a lot worse than the people in the boot houses because they got no escape from it. And it really was horrendous. They expected builders and demolition and people leaving, slowly being isolated. But the worst thing was the scavengers. The minute a house was boarded up originally with boards, they pounced. They took out all the electrical wiring, the copper pipes, if the toilet and the sink was fine, that went. And they took the pavement up and took that even. It was horrendous. Then they started putting, bricking it up. But quite a few times, the house that they were gutting, there was somebody living next door to them. And the police did the best. But with all the will in the world, they couldn't be everywhere at once. And some of the tales I could tell you, I'll tell you one funny one. We had a lady that was frightened of nobody. And what was her name now? I'll think of that. It comes with old age. She looked out of her window. She was in a brick house and saw somebody unloading a little white van. Rubbish onto the side of her property, her house. She called her son. She says, quick, get in your car and follow that van. I want to know where it goes. So he followed her and they went to a big posh house in Sutton. So we come back. She says, right, get your brother on the phone and tell him to come round with his van. So along comes the other brother. In it goes, all the rubbish is all in black plastic bags, builders, rubble and all sorts. And she took it and back. And she went and knocked on the door with the two sons, 6'2", built like a coal house. She said, I've bought you your rubbish back. She said, don't you think we've got enough to put up with how we're living without the people that haven't got to put up with bringing us all their rubbish? She said, I've bought it you back. And her lads unloaded it out the van onto their front lawn, and they all come home.
That's hilarious. That.
And that was becoming the spirit of Perry Common, because we were down, but we were not out.
That's tremendous. I was just going to say, that seems to encapsulate the spirit of... I've heard of... the sewage is not being blocked. Rats.
Yeah.
Can you tell us something about that?
While we had so much trouble with the sewerage, when Perry Common was built, the sewerage pipes weren't very deep. Now they have to be 3-4 times deeper. And as the bulldozer and that were going over the ground, they kept breaking open the sewers. And of course all the rats got out, all running round everywhere. It was pretty horrendous. It's just one thing like that sounds horrendous, but you've got to put that alongside different things. They started setting fire to the boarded up houses. And as I say, and you've got people living next to them. It really was a bad time. And then you'd have a street of people. Slowly they left, and there'd be perhaps two houses left in that street with somebody living in. And the one lady... when they were building the houses on the other side there, She there was only her in the whole of the street, and the policeman used to knock on the door every time he went back to see that she was all right, but she wouldn't move. She said, "No, I'm not moving till there's somewhere I can move into." And she went into one of the little bungalows in Phoenix Rise that she moved, but she wouldn't move. She said, "No." She says, I'm not letting the people like that," she says, "that come round and rats and that and do make me move when I don't want to." So she stayed where she was.
Excellent. And just a little thing. I heard that there were German prisoners of war. Italian prisoners of
yes.
war.
Yes.
Is that so?
Yes. That is why one of our roads is called Capolina Road. It's named. And also they had Italian road layers and builders come and help with the building, because there was, like, after the First World War, there was insufficient skilled people to do it, and a lot of them came over, and that is why Capolina is named Capolina, because that was where the majority of them had come from.
Right, so that wasn't Italian prisoners of war, was builders.
That was builders, yeah. I believe it was, I was told that it was the builders that built them in the 1920s. More than the, but I mean, could have had prisoners of war. I mean, the German prisoners of war worked in Aston Park.
I'm sorry, that was...
But, yeah, it's, but as I say, I do believe it was the workmen that worked on the building of the boot houses in the 20s.
Right. I'm trying to... Because I've heard it once or twice, but I've not been able to. I just wondered if you knew. No, Mrs. Pritchard, that's been fantastic. You've done quite... A good stretch.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's more, because obviously leading up to when you guys went into the... Because that's... I mean, it is a big span, isn't it?
Really? Yes, it is really,
it's a
yeah.
big span. So I think we can stop there and let me reflect on it in terms of what other... And then if there's any questions I need to ask, I'll prepare it for the next sort of session.
Yeah.
Which will take us up to... When things started getting a bit boring, you needed to go around the country to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And what's also interesting is how yourself, Linda, Mary, you know, you have almost, you know, from not, this thing fell in your lap, you know, in terms of, your commitment and the training and getting the knowledge and building the confidence to be so involved in community. And I think that's a very inspirational track, which for you is probably just, that's just how you guys were doing things. But for other people, for younger people, for people who are apathetic, for people who feel, well, what can we do?
Yeah,
you know, I think it's really, really... You know, from my part of the world, when there's war, you know, uneducated, people living in the rural areas, they get up the next morning and they're still ironing their clothes, get ready, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think your story is similar. And in England, we have everything, really, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I know people have hard times, but you're going to find some food. You're going to, do you know what I mean? We feed our dogs, for goodness sake, do you know what I'm saying? So that part is something I'm really interested in terms of your involvement in the association.
Yeah, we'll get that. But as I say, one of the things that when we first started, not so much the people on the committee, but when the people were being rehoused, there was the council and there was the people. And the people said, "Oh, that lot there," you know, and that they'd got no time for any of the council workers. And two young council officers were given Perry Common to look after. One was Ian Rathband and one was Gail Long. And when they first started working on the estate, it was, that lot from the council. Then it was, I'll go up the housing and see what them young, two young people think about it. Oh, they've got sorted out. Then it was, oh, I'm going up to see Gail and Ian. And then it was, hello, Gail and Ian, come on in, have a cup of tea, you know. And those two young people, it changed the way that the residents interacted with the council. It was no longer them and us, it was us. And I mean, they worked so hard. And with the residents, that when people had got to move out, if they were elderly, we'd Bill's and my husband had go and put the curtain rails up for them and decorate a living room for them. And the day we'd go in and help them pack up and then unpack the other end. We helped one another. We helped one another. And Gail and Ian was in there amongst the middle helping as well. And they did everything they could to find people properties that they wanted. There was one incident where this elderly gentleman, he wanted a house on a corner with not too much garden. And he wanted a little bit of garden at the back. He wanted three bedrooms. He didn't want a porch. And Gail says, I'll try and find you one. She found me exactly what he wanted. She said, oh, I've got you what house that you want. She said, it's this, that and the other. He turned it down because it was too far away from the bus stop. Gail says, amen, start again.
Where are they now?
Gail and Ian. Ian, he still works for the council. But Ian, he went, the last I heard of him, he was doing tracking down rent arrears.
And
Gail got three children and she only worked part-time. The last I heard, she'd moved out of the city. But they did sterling work.
And from what year to what year?
Pardon?
What year were they?
That I couldn't be sure of.
What year did they start? What year were they?
Did they first start?
Yeah.
When they came to the first meeting.
That very first, with five people.
To the five meetings, it was Gail and Ian that was there.
When I said
we looked at the last I heard, Ian was at Rough Road Housing. Are you recording this now?
I'm not filming, we just ran out of battery.
No. So what I'm saying is not on, because I don't know whether they'd want me to say this, but we got to love them so much. We rejoiced when Gail had her little girl, and we were worried to death when Ian's wife had a terrible illness, and we rejoiced for the one and grieved for the other. And as if they were family, which they were then. Yeah, but Ian's wife recovered and Gail had a baby and I think is now going to university. But it's Ian Rathband, and the last I heard he was at Rough Road, but I haven't heard anything of Gail Long for some time.
Okay, my children. Yes, we're good. Okay, sorry, the names were... Okay, thank you very much, Mrs. Pritchard. This is, it's now 5 o'clock, 26th of November. We are going to, as I said, let you have the transcripts and if there's anything you'd like to add. We'll do that. Hopefully we'll be able to meet up again. We'll give you more notice this time. And I'll try and do it on a day that's not so busy.